finished about half as far down as we were on the day. For instance, we were on the NASDAQ, finished down 140. It was down 300 at one point. S&P is down 15. I think it was at least down 40 at one point. So we made a pretty reasonable comeback on the close. However, it doesn't look like it's flying up here today at all either. So do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
Oh, we're just peachy. How are you?
Just, well, you know, just peachy. What can I say? We're up. You know, we looked at the obituaries, didn't see our name, and we came to work. You know, that's what Walter Brennan used to say.
The word this morning is ekranoplan, or ekranoplan.
What is
that? You know what one of those is?
No.
It is a ground effect vehicle. It literally is an airplane that is designed to fly typically no more than, say, 30 feet above the water. It flies over water for the most part, and is a because of the efficiencies of flying at that level, it literally rides on a bubble of air or ground effect. It can travel, you know, 250 miles an hour. It's very fuel efficient, and it because you're not using a lot of gas to get up into the air, it can carry a fair amount of weight a long distance at relatively efficient speeds.
Is it like a hovercraft almost, or is it?
Yeah, it's not, you know, a hovercraft, you know, blows air directly out from under it, and it lifts itself up off the ground on that contained area of air. An ekranoplane flies in something called ground effect, which is a compressed area of air that sits next to the ground, and an aircraft moving through it generates a compression wave in this zone that effectively bounces off the ground and then comes back up and provides lift to the aircraft. It's kind of the way pelicans fly, for example, where you'll see them just sit, you know, 4 to 5 feet off the water and just float. That's what this thing does. And there are a couple of ways of reinforcing the bubble. The Soviets built a couple of these huge versions of such an animal back in the 80s that they were going to use for troop carriers. And they're fast. They're much faster than hovercraft.
What would you do this in a hurricane? I think you'd have some trouble.
You would have trouble in certain sea states, yeah. But it's obviously not designed to fly in that kind of thing. But apparently we're testing, or this commercial company is testing one of these things in Rhode Island to start flying between I think they're actually considered vessels. On the surface of the water, because they operate so low,
but you could whack into a ship, right?
Right, and so they have to navigate around ships rather than over them. They're testing one of these things for a commercial transportation between, say, you know, coastal cities like Providence or whatever to New York City or to Boston. Anything that's got a coast, it would dock.
Does it drop down in the water and dock, or does it end up flying up in the air and land on a runway?
No, it docks. It's got a hull like a flying boat.
Okay.
So it cruises in this bubble of air for it could go a long ways because, again, it's fuel efficient. And they're looking right now at using one that's powered by electricity. Like, again, size is not as a big an issue as it is with a normal airliner. And, you know, cruises at this and
sounds like a nice ferry across Lake Michigan.
That's exactly where it would be perfect, would be in lakes. And in fact, the Soviets used to test theirs in the Caspian Sea, which is relatively calm. And there was a publication back in the 80s that I used as a source for a briefing called Soviet Military Power, and they referred to this thing as the Caspian Sea Monster. It was very, very hush-hush. The Soviets kept it very secret. If you look on Google for a ekranoplan, you'll see the rusting hulk of one of these things. I mean, it's huge. sitting on the shores of the Caspian Sea, where the Soviets just abandoned it when the USSR fell.
Really?
Yeah, I mean the video of it flying along is something, because it's got like I think six missile launch tubes on it, and as I said, it was designed to be a troop carrier, and it could carry I don't know if it could carry tanks, but it could certainly carry armored personnel carriers and other.
Whenever somebody mentions things that fly close to the water, I remember the book "The Man Called Intrepid," how they would get people back and forth behind the lines in France, and they had some little plane that was totally black, and it'd be the pilot. I don't know if it had a co-pilot, but they put whoever the person was would be in a trap door underneath. There wasn't even room for him in the plane, and they would fly across the channel so low that if it was any kind of waves, they'd have to have the windshield wipers on.
Same idea.
Well, then they would. Well, this was a regular plane, so then they would.
Yeah, so he's still flying in ground effect at that altitude.
Well, but he would. But these things, you know, they were capable of being regular planes. So then when they did,
right.
But then they would have one guy from the French Resistance with one flashlight, like in a field, and somehow these guys would navigate to the field. They get one flash of light, and the guy would use the flashlight as the or a candle or a lantern as the beam to come down on the field. The guy'd hop out. The guy who they're taking back to Britain would hop in, and they weren't on the ground more than a minute and a half, and off they were, and hope nobody hurt them. Do you think those guys had balls or what?
Well, yeah, flying, and your navigation system back then was pretty much dead reckoning. You're flying in the dark. You don't have radar on the aircraft, obviously. You can't see anything, so you're calculating your airspeed. You're looking at your airspeed, estimating that's comparable to ground speed. You're calculating your drift manually. I used to do this, by the way.
Well, then, but then you hope that you get the guy on the plane and you get up and gone before five Germans run out of the woods with machine guns.
Well, yeah, or that you don't happen to land where some German guy just lit a cigarette and you mistake that flash of light for a flashlight. The things we asked people to do are the things that they did during that conflict still just amaze me in terms of.
Well, I was watching once in a while on a Saturday night, if it's late and the dog wants to go out and I get back to sleep, I'll turn on the TV and they get 12 o'clock high on there, and which was a pretty serious show because people were getting killed the whole time in that show. I mean, for God's sake. And
Tom, I don't know if you know this, but the Army Air Corps and later Army Air Force lost more guys in aerial combat killed than the Marines did across the Pacific.
Well, didn't a whole bunch of them die in training too?
Yep. But the fatality rates in combat over there were unbelievable. It was an awful sacrifice for those crews.
It was like the German submarine guys; they all died too.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you would have on a raid like Schweinfurt or Regensburg or Ploiesti, you know, you'd lose 60, 70 aircraft. And all those crews were gone. I mean, you 600 men, just gone in one raid. I mean, guys that took a year to train, and they would just vanish in one mission.
Well, they relentlessly. One I was watching, and they were in this town, and they were somehow or another the Luftwaffe had a thing there, and they were forced to leave, but then they were counterattacking. So they sent Gallagher, wherever, in there to see if any of the records left by the Luftwaffe were something they need. And the Germans are coming down in this town like huge. And they're hanging in there, and they come across this kid and his brother. The kid's like 16, the brother's like 12. And people are dying, you know, a mortar shell land and somebody go down after you talk to him. As soon as you, on the TV, you get to like the guy, like he's from the Midwest, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden the guy's dead. Well, the kid finally is absolutely panicking with all these people around him dying. He says to Gallagher, he goes, how do you do this? How do you do the right thing all day long and don't let it get to you? And Gallagher says to him, he goes, the trick is when you start the day, you figure you're going to die. That's your thought process, and you do the right things to save everybody else, and maybe one of the people you save is yourself at the end of the day, but you figure you're gone starting out. I'm sitting there listening to this, watching the TV, I'm going, wow. Like, yeah. There's a thought, Lou.
Well, that fatalism resulted in one of the greatest American novels ever, Catch-22.
Yeah.
Which ought to be mandatory. I mean, when I read that when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, and I remember going through it and thinking this book should be mandatory reading for every military person in the U.S. because it captures that terrible fatalism so well. Fantastic book. And I probably need to go back and read it again because it was such a...
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, the movie's pretty good, but you got to read the book.
But you look at it, and when I mean, it perfectly captures that terrible black humor that service members, develop when you see people getting killed or you're killing people and your friends are getting wounded or blown up or whatever. There's a song called "Oh What a" or a movie called "Oh What a Lovely War," about World War One that captures a bunch of the. It's actually a musical. I believe it started as a musical, but it has in it running through it the songs that the soldiers sang, to themselves in World War One, and it's things like the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. I mean, it's this unbelievably sort of self-preservation or one ditty after another about self-preservation and the kind of random death that was being dealt out.
Well, the randomness has to be really hard to take on top of everything else. I mean,
it caused the loss of faith for I think it was for C.S. Lewis. Who Lyndon is a relatively straightforward, Anglican guy, and at the end of it came out a complete atheist based on what he had seen, and it affected a whole. I mean, the guys that survived, it affected a whole group of British, unbelievably talented British writers who survived the war, and who turned all of that. That terrible angst and those visions into epics like Narnia and Lord of the Rings.
Well, I remember some of the shows that lasted a long time on TV. The shows from the 50s and the 60s. I mean, one of them was Bonanza. And if you look back and ever watch any of the reruns, it's amazing how ahead of their time they were, and how if you're gonna have a show that lasts that long, how you needed the different personalities. You need some more of a comic relief, you need somebody who was real serious, and you need all that kind of stuff. Well, Pernell Roberts was the real serious guy, and Adam Cartwright, and they had some group there that was, they were some war guys or something, and one dude was a medal winner, and at some point they asked, one of the women asked, or one of the guys asked Adam, what is, the guy's a hero, and Adam said, well, you really have to remember that virtually all acts of heroism are really acts of desperation.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's, that's the test. And I'm reading a book on Stoicism now. It's a great book called How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, but it's really about Marcus Aurelius. And the Stoic philosophy is the fighting man's ethic, which is you are in a world that has huge elements that you can't control, and that will sweep you up, will sweep up your friends, and death is inevitable, and so your challenge as a person is to face these things with dignity and with courage, and understand that there are the only thing you can control at the end, in the face of these events, is how you die. And you can't think about and worry about what other people think about you. You can only establish what you know, the value of yourself to yourself. Really, I first became exposed to that in a piece by, I don't know, Philip Sticks, not Stye, it may have been, I keep thinking it was Stockdale. He was a vice presidential candidate for the crazy Texas billionaire, we'll say Perone, but that's not it.
What was his Perot, name? Ross Perot.
Perot. He was Stockdale. So Stockdale,
yeah, he was a general or something, wasn't he?
Admiral.
Admiral, okay.
And a POW in Vietnam for like 7 years. And he wrote a brilliant essay that I would refer the listenership to called The World of Epictetus, which Epictetus was one of the original Stoic philosophers. And this essay is just an absolutely brilliant piece on surviving this horrific environment in the prisoner of war experience in North Vietnam, and again how you have to understand, you know, the things that you can control, the things you can't, and you know, to be of value to yourself, you have to turn inward, because only you know what you're thinking, and only you know how you are responding to these challenges.
One of our biggest original clients, and someday, Lou, you'd appreciate it more than most. I have to give you the CW story from kind of start to finish, but he's quite the character. He was a B-24 navigator, and he went down. He was a POW, and had all these properties in Arizona. He had all these properties in Indiana, and he had these properties up in the Lake of the... You ever heard of the Lake of the... Was it the Lake of the Island? Or the Bay of the Islands up in Lake Huron?
Yes.
He had like three islands up there that Audrey and I went and visited. It was like, God.
No man is an island, but a man might be three islands.
Well, he and his wife would go up there like 2-3 weeks before anybody else was there. They'd stay 2 or 3 weeks after everybody else was gone. They were fine with it. And, as time went by, they ended up with, you know, running water. They ended up with, septic fields. You had to bring your own dirt out to make the septic field. Anyway, the place ended up like how's beautiful. Audrey's got some pictures someday when you're back in Chicago. So we went up there and stayed. But he couldn't stand Clinton, and he was very concerned about I don't know if you know anything about estate taxes, but he was so concerned that he was going to get stung with these estate taxes.
That's coming back up again.
Well, it's his. Has really nothing to do with the rates. It has to do with, I don't have this kind of stuff, but I mean, most people who are listening probably don't either. But evidently, they at the time will come in, and especially if they didn't like you, they would. If you ever see an estate sale, now granted, the numbers are up so much, even an estate sale that you and I might go to, you know, on a Sunday drive by. They're probably not paying any estate taxes. I don't know what the number is, but it's, you know, it's up into the millions, isn't it? Well, in those days, it wasn't that high. So if they walk in and say, well, Lou, that you sit there, you see that painting you got up there? And he goes, yeah, well, who painted it? Well, Jim Lawler. Okay, when he was 25. Yeah, well, unbeknownst to you, Jim is now painting in France, and his stuff's worth like $1 million. By the way, that's painting's worth $1 million. You owe us $333,000 or some crap. And you sit there and go, at the estate sale it goes for $2,000. They still want your $333,000. So his wife, when he moved out to Arizona, had befriended this Native American Indian artist when the guy was in his 20s. And I don't know what he did for him. I don't know if he did some land, I don't know. But she befriended the guy and kind of gave him some cash. And he would give her sculptures and paintings. Well, all of a sudden, the guy gets smoking hot, right, as an artist. And they've got probably 80 pieces of the guy. And, you know, they were nice. I don't know, art from scratch, from squat. But, it was good stuff. And he was afraid they were going to come in and say, well, that's $500,000 a piece. You owe us, like, 20 mil. Now, I actually, we don't do insurance and PTI, but I really like the guy. So I hooked him up with somebody, and it turns out that even though he was older, he and his wife were very healthy, and if they had an insurance, the trick was to have enough insurance that when the bleep holes came in to do this to you, if they wanted to, they'd say, you owe us 10 mil, the estate could just write the check and say, okay, get out of here. But he for some reason, he didn't want to do it. Anyway, he becomes he renounces his citizenship. This is a guy who's a POW. Becomes a citizen of the Isle of Man, which was a big procedure.
Yep. I had some Russian clients do that.
Well, he becomes a resident of Bermuda. Evidently, I don't know, who's Bermuda? Are they British? Well, I mean, nobody wants to be a British.
Well, they used to be a British colony, but they're an independent nation now.
But for some reason, you can't get citizenship there. You got to get somewhere else, then you become a resident of Bermuda. Anyway, so he gets a place there. This all costs an arm and a leg, because now you need a Bermuda bank account. You need to get your Bermuda driver's license as a full day, even though you've been driving your whole life. You know, this kind of crap. Well, his three neighbors are Ross Perot and the two kids, his two sons. They had already, when the guy ran, they had already had their escape pod in case they didn't win and didn't want to be here anymore. They already had their spot in Bermuda. I don't know. Ross Perot died. I wonder if the kids are still there or whether they're still alive or whatever, but they had already made their sort of escape. And it's one of the things I look at when I see what's happening in the economy, Lou, and I wonder, you know, politics aside, you wonder if the people who are sort of, I use the term in charge, the guys who have benefited dramatically by the economic policies and by the way the world and the market has gone, that have, you know, the billions and billions of dollars and everybody else is cutting coupons. And they, I don't think, have the affinity for the U.S. that maybe we think they should. They become Harold Janines. I mean, I don't think that, the Gateses and the Zuckerbergs of the world care if they live here or somewhere else.
So I have, I'm going to rant. You mind if I rant?
Go ahead. I do all the time. It's your turn.
I have a close associate that is one of these people. At the first sign of a political event they don't like, and they're anti-Trumpers. So they have Trump derangement syndrome, but it goes deeper than that. So at the first indication of whatever, this person starts talking about getting other passports. You know, they're U.S. citizens, grown up in the United States, etc., although they have lived abroad for some time. But they're back in the U.S. now. But they start talking about getting, you know, looking around desperately, trying to find other passports that they could possibly qualify so that they could, you know, if they have to go somewhere, they're not traveling as U.S. citizens, they're beyond the reach of U.S. law, they can get themselves to you know, someplace. And, you know, my reaction to that, you know, they are literally global citizens. They don't give two hoots about the United States, although they will tell you that they're, you know, they want the U.S. is the place they want to be, but they're not. They're in many ways they're anti-American, and in terms of their loyalty to the U.S. And in fact, their loyalty is to whatever passport they think is going to provide them with economic security and allow them to move their money and whatever. But I got irritated with this person one time and said, "Let me explain something to you, just from a philosophical honesty perspective. Your global citizenship rides on the back of that U.S. passport, whether you want to acknowledge it or not. And that's because the United States, for better or worse, is the guarantor of this whole system that you have taken advantage of and have done very well in, and that you are now seeking to exploit." I said, "Do you think if you run to some place like Panama or Costa Rica or, you know, Ireland or Switzerland, do you think the security of that place is going to last 10 seconds if the United States decides it or is defeated?" you are effectively abandoning the entity that guarantees the security for the world. I mean, for better or worse.
Well, we have. Not so sure we're planning on doing it much further.
Well, and that's the wake-up call that Europe received 10 years ago, and that it's getting jolted again. But, we're looking around saying, can we do this, or how can we do this? But the short answer is, if you want to be a citizen of the world and a globalist, and you go to Davos and hobnob with your other global elite friends, and you act in interests that are inimical to those of your home country, you undercut the very thing that makes your life so enjoyable, and that is the global world order, because the entity that secures that, the entity that secures the shipping lanes, the entity that secures the military stability of things like NATO and CETO and those other organizations, is the good old US of A, for better or worse. And if you don't acknowledge that, or you whatever, then you're simply being a hypocrite. And there are thousands of these people who would flee this country at the drop of a hat, but take full advantage of this country's ability and
I would push back on that,
to make this defense.
I would push back on that a hair a little. There isn't anybody who can disagree with what you just said, I don't think. The question is as I tell potential clients, I wish we could trade the last decade's market. We'd be pretty good at it. But we can't. We have to trade the next decade's market. You just described your view of the U.S. and mine, and it's why we love it to death. But to think it's not changing.
Oh, I don't say that it's not changing.
But I mean, I had a conversation with my brother, and I said, and for he and I, Lou, I don't, I'm here. I mean, I'm not going anywhere. But now my nephew has two daughters. They're like 3 and 8, and I said, we should probably think about getting our Irish citizenship. I don't want those girls walking down the block with masked people with rifles standing in front of the school building. That's not my U.S. It seems to be somebody's U.S. The idea that you can sig the Justice Department, and I'm not saying only the Republicans are doing it. I'm saying, but the idea that you can sig the Justice Department on somebody because you don't like them, and somehow they come up with documents, IRS documents and stuff that only a few years ago were considered pretty sacred. Where does this end? And to think that you might need an escape for a while is probably not crazy.
Don't go to Ireland. I don't know if you've been following what's going on over there.
Where else am I going to go? I'm Irish.
Well, I don't know, but I wouldn't go to Ireland.
Okay, can I get my Italian passport?
Ireland is being swamped by immigration issues.
Okay,
I
didn't say any place was perfect.
I'm just saying if you're gonna run, I don't.
This and I sent out a thing yesterday. Two things are seem to be pounding at me, Lou. So actually, I don't know if you listened to the show the other day. One of the guys we play softball with, nice guy, just had a birthday. And he's over at my brother's on Sunday, because everybody knows we all get together. Because I came by just to listen to the show. I want to ask you a question. And he goes, you and your bro. He goes, because you guys on the show are a cut above. He says, the stuff you talk about, and money supplies and inflations and this and monetary theory and things like that, and some of the history with some of the people on the show, he even mentioned you. He goes, what percentage, if you just went on regular radio or TV, what percentage of the people have any idea what the hell you guys are talking about? And I said, 10%. And he goes, you're way high. He goes, we have sort of dumbed things down so much, people have no idea what you're talking about. You can lie to people all day long and they believe you. He goes, I don't know how. He goes, I'm just a blue collar schmuck. He goes, I don't see how people believe this crap from both sides. I mean, we had the president of the Bears on Sunday night, or whatever the hell night it was, He's walking around trying to get people for a stadium, telling people it's 56,000 jobs. 56,000? Where does that number come from? What's if they start building the thing tomorrow? How many construction workers are going to be working? 500 maybe. Where do you pick 56,000 out of your ass? People just I see people on CNBC all
day. Are they going to have one hot dog vendor for every two people at the stadium?
I guess
is that the calculation?
I mean, and now
that's a lot of hot dogs.
And that's what 12 games a year, 12 times a year. But the idea that you. I use the term exaggerate or talk about this stuff, and people believe this. Why do people believe this crap?
Because they want to. I mean, if you're, you know how this works. If you're you want a new Bears stadium, I mean, especially since it looks that you've had one good preseason game with your quarterback. How long do you give it before they ruin Williams? If you want to believe this, if you want the new stadium, then you latch on to anything. The important element of persuasion there, as Scott Adams would say, would be to give people hooks that they can tie into this idea of a new stadium so that they can latch onto it. And one of the hooks is a number. So that 56, I'll probably remember that 56,000 number.
Well, I do.
Next week, next couple of weeks in my head. This is part of the persuasion thing. People come in with a very, very few people come into a situation and have an initial situation explained to them that don't form an immediate narrative in their heads as to what likely happened or what explains it or I want this to happen, and so you try to give them as much detail as you can that allows them to hook on to your idea so that they come up in your favor. So number job numbers, carbon footprint, whatever you think is gonna latch into or allow people to latch on to your concept in the way you want them to. That's what you do. So this is part of this persuasion thing that runs on us continuously. And because of the ubiquity of media, social and otherwise, we're constantly bombarded with that stuff, and it requires, and I don't do it all the time. I fall for it too. Everybody does. It's part of our nature, but it requires a constant filtering of, wait a minute, who's saying this? Why are they saying it? Does this number sound like it makes sense? If you want to see the deep state or whatever you want to call it efforts at this in full color and with a lot of hindsight, look at what happened during COVID, when all that information was pouring out about the illness, about where it came from, about how it worked on people.
That landed on us so fast, Lou.
It did, but that's why it's a perfect case study. You know, what was being spun, you know, what was known to the people that were spinning these narratives or that were putting these narratives together, and what they did in an effort to give us things to hook onto so that we would believe the preferred narrative.
Lou, how much Having said that, I was going to walk off on a tangent here, but what said is
not
interesting.
One of those.
I read this thing.
That's what we're doing this morning.
Well, that's okay. But I read this thing long ago on the show. It was an article that I, of course, can't find because my brother. I used to run all this stuff off. My brother accused me of killing trees, so I just put everything in my favorites, and then all of a sudden, one Microsoft. All my favorites are gone. But this article was in there. It had to do with. It didn't talk about lack of education. It didn't talk about mental laziness. It just talked about most people. It has to do with where to vote, and most people realize that even though you want to vote because it's your right, and you know, and I always do, but I also know whether I get on the block or not doesn't really make any difference. You know, it's not going to be Virginia City with Ben Cartwright flipping the coin, or whether little Joe or Hoss or Mayor. So most people, what they do is they have real jobs, they have real families, they have stuff to do. and they don't have the time that I have, because that's what I do for people, and you do just because you do it, keep track of a lot of the stuff. And they said, what you end up doing is you're becoming mentally lazy, and whatever your side, if you're right or left, you immediately think of an issue, and the first thing you think of is, where's my side feel about this one, and you drop into it. But he didn't go into whether the education is getting dumbed down to enough where they didn't know. So he basically said, a lot of people, I mean, you don't find very few people drop, and actually there's people on the show that don't do it, they're brilliant. An issue drops in front of them, they don't read it themselves and decide, okay, where do I stand on this? They'll say, wait a minute, where does Trump stand on this? Or where do the Democrats, where are the guys who hate Trump? And that's how you make your decision. Well, to me, that's so friggin' ignorant, I can't go there. But that's just a comment. But now it's to the point where people, Otter and I were at dinner Saturday, and we always sit at the bar because we end up talking to people. Well, of course, this guy next to Audrey, and she is an out and out Trumper. So they start talking and all this kind of stuff. And she goes, well, Tom doesn't feel that way. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be dragged into this, really. I'm enjoying
this could ruin a dinner.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of my lasagna, which was pretty good, and so the guy, they're talking about how much we're going to benefit from all these people paying all this money for the tariffs. And I go, well, you got to realize that you're the one paying the money for the tariffs. And he goes, well, why do you say that? And obviously, people from the other countries pay it. I said, no, they don't. And then he said, well, no. As soon as Trump gets rid of this idiot Powell, and we get our interest rates down to 1%, you won't believe the growth in this country. I said, if they pour more money into the system and the inflation goes up, your long-term rates are going to go up, even if the short ones go down for a little while, and you're not going to like what you see. It's going to be 1982 again. The guy looked at me. He had no idea what I was talking about. Well, and here's a guy in real estate that should know how interest rates move, should know what the economy looked like when long-term rates are 8 or 10%. And he has no idea or doesn't want to know. And how does anybody not know that some absorption happens in the price overseas if they bring stuff over here and they want to stay competitive? If there is a competition, they probably will absorb some of that. And to that extent, you're hurting somebody overseas, if that was our goal in the first place. To that extent, could that happen? Yes. The other thing is, some people here might actually raise their prices, but the bottom line is, the actual money filtering into the government from the tax is from here. And there's no way anybody can debate that one way or the other. That's just the way it works. Now, for some very competitive stuff, you could conceivably have a foreign guy having to lower his prices so much that the tariff here only evens things up, okay? So the price ends up being the same. That could happen, rarely. But it's not going to happen generally, and there's going to be some stuff that has no competition here that the tariff is just 100%. So, this is stuff I think everybody who's... I don't know how anybody could debate me with that, honestly. I mean, yet people do. I'm not saying some of it's not going to be absorbed. I'm not going to say some of the companies here might absorb it. But the bottom line is, if you take every single item and trace it through, you're going to find some that are very competitive, some that aren't competitive. We buy cola nuts from someplace. There aren't any cola nuts here. There's no competition. So the cola nut is going to be 100% tariff on us. How else could it not be, Lou? I mean, but fortunately, there's not very many things like cola nuts. Everything else has probably manufacturers here too. But why do people, not just because you happen to like Trump or the Republicans or don't like the Democratic side of the fence, which I don't like much either, it doesn't change the facts. Yet people seem to want to jump onto this stuff. Well, that's what my guy says. I'll believe it. I'm like, what do we... How did we get there, Lou, on both sides? Because I see that on the other side, too. On the Democratic side, I go, guys, you better get a new shtick if you want to win. What are you doing?
Well, the Democratic, apparently, based on the stories I was hearing yesterday, that the Democratic worldview is being repudiated en masse by a significant percentage of new voters and voters that are being surveyed right now. But regardless... So the Stoic, I'm going to try to draw this around full circle. The Stoic or at least tie it back to something we were talking about earlier. The Stoic would say, I think, you have an obligation to your own mental health and your own mental development to not accept the words of anyone except as you can verify them, and you must constantly be looking at your own, you know, they would call them your own hungers, your own desires, to analyze, you know, whether your desires are coloring and distorting your worldview. And you can't rely on people around you to do that. You can only rely on yourself. And you must again run a constant internal dialogue of, am I making this decision or do I have this belief because it is an accurate reflection of the world, or do I have this belief because it benefits me? And I mean, that's a very simple way of putting it, but that's one of the tremendously appealing aspects of Stoicism, is that it basically says you must confront reality. You know, you must look at the world as it is, not as you want it to be, and adjust your view accordingly. And to do that, as I said, requires this constant inner dialogue, that when you are confronted with an idea, and the Stoic says, you know, you look at an idea, and is it something that affects me? Is it something that affects the people I care about? If it is, then you know, analyze your opinion on it and look at how it affects the world, and look at your desires, and are they affecting that perception? And acknowledge and you know, cut through the desire to get an unvarnished view of the world. It's this by the way, this particular philosophy, you could almost see a straight line from the allegory of the cave, you know, Plato's brilliant assessment of looking at, you know, the guy trapped in the cave who can only see, you know, there's a fire behind him and he can only see the shadows on the wall. He can't see himself or his fellow prisoners that are shackled in the cave. They can only see shadows. And so the Stoic says, you know, are you looking at shadows, or are you looking at the world as it really is? And you know, the short answer is that takes a lot of effort, and it takes a certain level of mental discipline that I freely admit I don't have all the time. And it requires this constant focus, but it does cause you to assess the world based on what, you know, what you perceive as reality, and not on what you want it to be or what you hope it would be. And I think part of the problem, Tom, is that we, in our political discussions, we have lost nuance, and we have lost a kind of balancing where people can say, yeah, I think this, I generally am going to vote for this guy, or I generally support this guy, but that doesn't mean I think what he's saying right now is stupid or is wrong or is deceptive. And we don't seem to be able to do that. It's got to be all, you know, everything this candidate does is great, and everything the other candidate does is evil.
Yeah.
And I mean,
I would add one wrinkle to that, though. Some of the stuff that Trump has done, in terms of, I never agree with the way he does anything, but certain things he has done, if he would have couched it a little different way, I certainly would agree with it. But I will add one wrinkle to it that I don't think I've ever seen, and I know the minute I say this, everybody's going to go, yeah, well, what about Hunter Biden? What about, you know, blah, blah, blah. What about Nancy Pelosi? We in this country, I don't think in my lifetime, have ever seen the interplay of somebody essentially doing business out of the White House to the extent where he's running his own empire. I mean, if you go back and look at the Weimar Republic fiasco, and people, anybody who hasn't read a little bit into it, and I need to know more. When you look back and say, why would anybody have had a policy like that? Now, what they did is they poured money into the system, so their money was worth nothing. So when they paid the money to France and England, they were paying them with stuff that was basically worthless. And it was a plan to renegotiate Versailles, which ended up being successful in that regard. But now you look at the benefactors of that. The people that had to get off at lunch to go buy bread because they couldn't afford it by night, they weren't the benefactors. And guess what, Lou? That's us. But German landowners and people who owned fixed assets, meaning Trump and his family, all of a sudden, when you double the prices, the mortgage doesn't get adjusted. All of a sudden, those guys are walking down to the bank and they're paying off their mortgage in 6 months. And the bank's like, okay, well, I guess that's our deal, but boy, that money isn't worth the same as when I gave it to you. Still, some of the biggest landowners in Germany got their land 100 years ago during the Weimar Republic. And when you have somebody who is negotiating all this stuff, or his family or the people around him, I'm going to say the mortgage on a Doral now, if it's not already paid off, and if we inflate even more, people like that who know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it, they're going to leave the rest of us. I mean, you know, Trump's great-grandkids 100 years from now, they're going to wonder where they got all this property if he inflates this thing even more like he wants to. When a new get interest rates down to a zero, so what if CPI is 10%, we'll fire that guy too. This is not just a mistake on somebody's part. This is on purpose.
Well,
I don't think you could ever accuse Harry Truman of making a policy decision so he made money.
Well, no, Truman was the
exception. Or I don't think you would even accuse Kennedy of that, or maybe even Johnson.
But regardless, I'm not going to defend. I'm not so much concerned about Donald Trump's personal wealth issue as I am about the way his kid, at least one of his kids, and a number of the children of other cabinet officials seem to be making bank on their parents' reputations, which I don't like, and I think it's going to be a scandal.
Well, I sent you the thing yesterday. Trump has made 690 bond trades since he's been in office. That doesn't even include the stock and commodity trades. What the hell? Is the presidency a part-time job or what?
I don't know enough about that, Tom. I don't know whether is he personally.
I don't know. How do you know? I don't know.
It,
I mean,
is it what's the source? Is it his investment team?
Is it some group that keeps track of this that CNBC always quotes? They do it for everybody.
But who's?
I sent it to you. I know. I sent it to you.
Is Trump picking the phone up and saying?
That's what I'm saying. If he is, that's pretty bizarre. I can't imagine that happening.
I would doubt that. I suspect that's his investment team doing that with behind the scenes.
Well, but we're also talking about the government taking chunks, and you were, by the way, you're being quoted the last 2 days big time. This has become...
God, the show's going down.
No, you're the one who brought up that is a fascist economic system, and we're going right there. There's three or four firms that seem to have the blessing of the White House that in every industry with their nose up the ass of government. You're the one who...
But yeah,
10 years.
I'm death on that stuff, and it's a real problem, and I'm hoping that there will be some exposure on that eventually. I'm sort of amazed. What surprises me is that, you know, instead of going after that, instead of pulling the curtain back on those kinds of activities, the Democratic Party is screaming about. Some cause du jour, whether it's Sidney Sweeney in blue jeans or Texas is redistricting or whatever, because they have no focus. I don't understand why they're not raising that.
Why one of my friends in the Tripoli, young lady, and she just finished her psychology degree, believe it or not, going like at night when tens bar, and but she's a real bright lady. She goes, one of the Democrats going to figure out. They need an older white guy with some serious experience to tell the other knuckleheads in the party to shut up for a while and actually do some damage to these. What's going on? I said, I don't know. I don't think it's ever going to come to that.
They're gonna have real trouble with that because of the identity politics that they that they've embraced over the last, 25 years. There was an interesting, to again go back to your earlier point, there was an interesting article that I read, I can't remember where, but it talked about the malign influence of Barack Obama on American race relations.
I would agree with that, by the way.
Yeah, I would too. And I mean it, but it was a very thoughtful piece that just said, race relations were actually improving dramatically through the 90s and into the early aughts. And the presidency of Barack Obama in large part by design, because of his worldview and the worldview of the people he surrounded himself with, it just began to disintegrate. And it really is a sort of a stunning reassessment of that presidency. Although I'm not sure from the author's perspective it was a reassessment. I think the authors believe that.
Well, in my high school years, and to a huge extent at Notre Dame, because probably a little of the history of Ted Hesburgh. I mean, the guy could have been as conservative in some ways as Attila the Hun, but in terms of race relations, those kinds of things, he was about as out there as you could be. And in my high school, the idea, I mean, we read a boatload of Martin Luther King, and he was up there in the philosopher list like Abraham, for God's sake. And I'm a real follower of that dude and what he said. And I tell you what, that I don't know where that puts me now. It certainly doesn't put me anywhere in the Democratic field.
No, that's a horrible indictment. But in any event, to go back to our theme here on persuasiveness, the Stoic approach to this, this constant reassessment and this constant assessment of your appetites. That's the word I was looking for. I said hunger, but I meant appetite. Your appetites and how your appetites drive your worldview is a practice that, as I said, I ever since I read that piece by Stockdale, I've sort of gone back in. Another place, by the way, you find a relatively good discussion of the Stoic and how the Stoic approaches life is Tom Wolfe's book, A Man in Full, which is a story. It's a narrative about the New South. I'm a huge Tom Wolfe fan. I think I've
did
I've
he write what was the one that he wrote that I couldn't we had to read it in high school. What was the one where he was in Eastern Europe and God, that was a horrible book. What the hell was that? Something killer? Something angels or what the hell was it?
I don't know. He came on the scene. First of the Right Stuff, the movie.
Stuff. I'm talking about a different guy. All right.
That's Tom Wolfe. Bonfire of the Vanities. He's written a number of just fantastic pieces, but
that one I got about three quarters of the way through, and my mother told me the ending. I didn't finish it. I said, "Don't tell me the ending." And she told me the ending. But there's one page in that book, and I should grab it, Lou, and read the page. You know what I'm talking about? Where the guy was driving to work. When was that book published? 82?
81 or 82.
Well, the guy's driving to work, and when people asked him what he did for a living, he said, "I buy and sell money," and nobody knew what the hell he was talking about. He was an international currency trader in New York.
Yeah, and he refers to himself as a master of the universe because his kids are watching the cartoon show He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, and he thinks to himself, "That's me. I'm a master of the universe. I can do what I want," and this the book is a study of how hubris takes you and again, the Stoic. You can see this coming out in Wolf's stuff. The Stoic worldview. At the end, the guy is effectively a Stoic, but A Man in Full runs this out in a number of ways. But it's set in modern day Atlanta. It's a study of the modern South. And it's just a fantastic.
Well, there's a page in there, Lou. Read. Like you say, he thought he was a master of the universe. We're not ruining the book for anybody, but in reality, he knew better. There's a page, and if I had it, I'd find it. I'd read the whole page on here. It's that good. He made, what, $1 million a year in 1981.
Oh, yeah, he was a gazillionaire.
Well, he's driving to work. I don't know if he's in the back of the limousine or what he is, and he starts going through his head how much money he spent the year before.
Yep.
And he actually spent, like, what, $1.1 million or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about he had the wife, who was a raving bitch, and all she did was spend money. And then he had the girlfriend.
Yep.
So he'd leave the wife, and he'd go over to the girlfriend, and all she'd do was bitch at him about her apartment wasn't big enough, and she wasn't getting enough money. And they ended, what was the best one? They had the huge black tie affair on the same block that he lived, and the wife made him get a limousine so they could drive around the block, get dropped off in the limousine so they wouldn't...
Yes.
They wouldn't look. And she had the latest Mercedes, and what, she put 50 miles on it the year before, and it cost them $500 to park the thing or something?
Yep.
Or something. But he went through the whole list of his... Between the wife and the girlfriend, the guy wasn't happy at all. All he did was bitch at him. and yet everybody thought he was, and he thought somehow or another he was a master of anything, was he?
No. I mean, that's the genius of Wolf. His other, and I think, I'm just wondering if his fatalism in his, again, later novels where he's talking about this, the sort of, he adopts kind of the stoic worldview, arose out of his exposure to the combat pilots in Vietnam, because he wrote a piece for Esquire. Like, again, I'm reaching way back, and I'm sorry to the listeners about my going back on this, but if you want to read some fantastic, you know, just magazine writing, there's an article called Jousting with Sam and Charlie, and this is the story that led to him writing The Right Stuff, because it was his exposure to these carrier pilots flying off the deck, I think, of the Oriskany in Vietnam, but talking about the terrible risk and the losses and just the inherent danger, and then the thrill. He literally captures the incredible adrenaline rush that guys flying, you know, 300-400 feet off the ground at 500-600 miles an hour with people shooting at you and trying to, you know, deliver ordnance against the bad guys. It's a fantastic read, but that fatalism.
Well, why does everybody, even in The Right Stuff,
that fatalism in those articles,
even in The Right Stuff, the guy who was the head honcho at the Top Gun talked about being with Maverick's dad on the Oriskany. Was the Oriskany there pretty much the whole time? And it's always the carrier. But in fact, the guy used to work for us. He was in the Navy, but he was stationed on land, because some of the planes from the Oriskany would actually land on land and then do stuff, you know, from land, and then he'd go back to the Oriskany like a week later or something. So he was actually on land, even though he had his plane he was a mechanic for. But the Oriskany must have been there like almost the whole time.
I don't know, but you know, Tom Wolfe was very well read in the late 60s and early 70s, and it wouldn't surprise me that every screenwriter that wrote a story read that Jousting with Sam and Charlie and said, oh, okay, well, there's an aircraft carrier whose name's unusual. I can plug it in here. You know, the Enterprise was out there and a number of others as well. But that story, I could recommend, if you want to read some just fantastic writing, that story captures that, and I think may have been or latched into some of the fatalism that later and stoicism that later pervades Wolf's writing. Okay, enough about America.
Yeah, hey, we're down to three exhibition games now. I thought it was four. We're down to three, huh?
Yes. They're too risky. They're too expensive. You don't want your people out there playing unless it counts.
But now when they have the, like, the Bills and the Bears practice on Friday, is that more controlled than? Because I know Pete Najarian used to say that if you wanted to do practice intelligently, you would never have a full scrimmage, because people get hurt from people falling on them from behind. Because you should have one-on-one drills where you still could get hurt, but it's very rare. Usually it's a random thing. The Bears aren't scrimmaging the Bills, are they? Or what do they do? What kind of practice
they
do
they? If they are scrimmaging, they're scrimmaging on specific down and distance situations, where they will come out and go, okay, here's the down and distance, and they would do a full speed run. But remember, Tom, they're limited to the number of fully padded practices they can have. So what you're seeing, if you look at these team on teams drills, is everything but the full speed tackling. Now, they will do full-speed tackling days where they'll just beat on each other, but those are rare, and literally the games become kind of a test for brief periods, you know, 1, 2, 3 series of all your people going full speed, but the practices where they're engaging with other clubs, they can't hit full speed in those practices. They're running full speed, but they can't hit full speed. So you're getting a reasonably good look of your people against other people who are not on your team. So they're seeing different folks, and that lets you get a better picture of who's doing what and how your schemes are working.
Lou, last question, real dumb question. What happened to the guy a few years ago that had the moving tackling dummies, where people would tackle the tackling dummies, and you could move them just like they were a running back or something? You could actually run up and tab. Did that ever catch on or not?
I have not seen that catch on at all.
It looked pretty cool when it first came out, though, didn't it? All these things running around, and you could go up there and whack the dummy, and you know.
It's probably just cheaper to sign a bunch of free agents off the street and let them be the dummies.
Well, have a nice weekend, but now they don't play. They get a week off before they start, right? Next week college starts.
Yeah, they start something because the roster moves are so crucial and so expensive.
All right, bud. Jimmy, right. You want to go right to our guys?
Absolutely.
Well, real quick, S&P futures now down 17. Nasdaq futures down 53. So the S&Ps has dropped some, and the Nasdaq have dropped a little bit. But I'm kind of surprised the way we came back yesterday. I would have, if I was a wagering man, I would have said we'd be up this morning, but we are not. Andrew Wayne, how are you guys?
Very good. How are you doing?
Doing all right after Lou and I solved the problems of the esoteric world or whatever. Lou always brings some interesting stuff. I mean, it is when you look at what these guys do and have done, and you look at, you know, even stuff like, I'm sure you guys read The Bonfire of Vanities, and nothing really changes, does it? I mean, you talk about, you know, Harold Janine and wanting to be the head of the world, and governments were nothing but, you know, a little bump in the way, and you had to get them out of your way, right? And you kind of wonder if there isn't too much of that going on. I always tell the story that in World War II, if we had a guy like Andrew who managed to weasel a 10% over what he should have on a PT boat engine contract, how it really didn't matter much because he maybe paid his people a little more, and all the money went to the local bar and the local food store, and I guess it didn't matter all that much. But if all of a sudden the money's going somewhere else and people are just taking it, then it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Well, I would note that according to this morning's news, a few of the White House officials who have been involved with cryptocurrency policy have now gotten into that revolving door, and now they are out involved in cryptocurrency. So, and so it goes.
It's a little off the beaten topic with I usually talk to with you two learned gentlemen, but when something, and I bring this up a lot, when I went back and I did some research, and again, you guys are going to say you read more about this than me because you always do. I actually went back and read a lot on the tulip incident in Holland back in the day, and it seems like there's always somewhat of a progression to where when everybody just bought tulips, you know, you and Andrew went out and pulled the money out of your wallet and you paid $500 for a tulip. Well, nobody really gave a crap economically until they became so popular, because the worst that could happen is the price of the tulip went down, but you paid cash, and maybe you should have spent it on booze or women or houses or something, but the fact is, you're down some dough. But then all of a sudden, one day, they got so popular and they started being listed on they had actually exchanges at the time. I'm talking about the 1600s. They're listed on the exchange. But even that wasn't that big of a deal. But now, all of a sudden, people started lending people money, essentially were margin loans to buy tulips. And that's where your danger comes in. I mean, the reason why people sell stock at $50 because that they bought at $100 is not because they don't think it's a good value at 50. It's because they have a margin loan, they can't make the margin call, and they have to sell it, correct? So the pressure comes from the margin stuff. And yesterday, I was talking to one of the gentlemen on the phone, it might have been Russell, that there's, actually no, it was Hal on Tuesday, that we think there's $50, $60, $100 billion now of loans and the crypto, various types of the crypto, and some people have taken second mortgages out of their house and bought the stuff. And so far they've been okay with it. But now there's like some pressure on it. And it's not just a bunch of people running the price up, because there's some pressure on it. And now the total value is up to $2 trillion. So it's not peeing in Lake Michigan anymore. It's a real number. What kind of danger do you think that may or may not have to the market and everything else? I mean, what if that goes? What if it drops by half? I mean, where do you see? I can't tell who's got the stuff. Who would be at risk? It can't be just a bunch of drug dealers. I mean, who is it? Do you guys have a clue?
Well, here's a quick thought. If it's self-contained, then the dangers are somewhat modest for the public. But if you have public officials who are in the regulation business, particularly at a federal level, and they're either invested themselves or beholden to people who are, and of course the president is heavily invested, and then they use the existing financial systems as a backstop, then we're all at risk. And so I think that's the point to focus on. Will our core financial institutions step in to help these speculators if and when a crash comes?
You mean that the Fed would be stepping in and buying Bitcoin? I know you're not crazy by saying this, because I could see it happening too, but boy, that would really be something.
Well, you have a situation where the powers that be say we can't have this suffering in the financial markets. Everybody must pitch in through our national institutions and assets to help these poor, suffering crypto investors.
Who do you think they are?
Well, we know.
I know this administration is all over it. But I mean, in terms of out of the $2 trillion, how much of it do you think is U.S. held? How much do you think of it's drug held? I mean, I have no idea. Does anybody know?
No, because one thing that Elon Musk and Trump have done is they've laid off quite a few people who in the government who were responsible for tracking fungible and non-fungible wealth transfers, be it money or blood diamonds or and crypto. And now we've seen both the intelligence community and the Treasury Department laying people off whose job was to, well, who's involved in this stuff? And
well, how do you find out? I mean, the way that it's, I mean, I don't know that much. We've had people on the show that explain it, and I got a little bit of an idea. I mean, Carl and Kevin know more than me, but I don't. The idea that, I mean, Kenny, I kind of was jousting with Kenny a little bit. He goes, well, it's going to be regulated. I go, Kenny, how the hell are you going to regulate it when there's nobody you can call? I mean, who do you regulate? He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, if they want to regulate PTI, they call my brother up and say, send me the stuff. Who do you call in the crypto world? How do you regulate anything like that?
Yeah, I suppose it's the crypto exchanges. Now, you know, I made this huge investment of $10 in Bitcoin just to have a reason to check it out every once in a while. But I guess that's my account is held by some crypto exchange tied in with PayPal, apparently. Another Elon Musk, Peter Thiel operation. And so essentially, I guess, if I want to cash out, I can cash out, and then it'll go on to the cash side of my PayPal account.
Well, did you, we could have bought when I first met you dudes. We could have, I think we probably could still buy one. You can actually buy a Bitcoin vending machine.
Ah.
And my brother, when it first came out on the south side, They were in the currency exchange, and in the one store that's frequented mostly by, I'll say, the people from the hood, and they were buying this stuff. And the weird part of it is, if I think the machine also doubled as an ATM if you wanted to convert it. It was pretty expensive. But I think he did better than you. I think he did $20. And I think the transaction...
That's over 40 now.
Well, but I think the transaction fee was 4. So it was like 20%. So only like 16 went into the... And then, of course, he lost his password. So now he has no idea what it's worth.
Oh, God.
It is. But, I mean, I don't... If it was just, you know, a couple of hundred billion, I'm sounding like a politician, I guess I wouldn't be worrying about it. But if it's up to 2 trillion, if it were to go to half of that, somebody's in trouble someplace. What, are they going to have to sell stocks? Are they going to have to sell houses? What do they have to do?
I suppose they're going to have to either do that or find a tall building to jump off of.
God. Well, what's a lot of stuff going on in Washington this week. What in do you think? If in his unorthodox way of doing stuff, if Trump were to pull this, you know, peace thing off, I will take my hat off and look to Washington. I hope it works. I don't know that it's going to. Seems like there's too much Trump in there and not too much solution, but that's just my style. I mean, if his style works, you know, fine. They're not calling me. What kind of a cat do you think this Putin really is? I mean, I know I have my opinions, but is he the deranged, you know, totally psychotic that I think he is, or is he? Those guys are usually pretty smart, though.
No, I think you're right on the psychotic part. He was a KGB officer. He was based in Dresden, and what was East Germany. His job entailed everything you could imagine a KGB officer would do. Everything from trying to turn West Germans and U.S. troops stationed in West Germany, turn them into agents for the Russians. He was involved in blackmail operations against West German politicians, and they did nail a couple. And this is the kind of guy he is. But in a wider view, he also wants to recreate not the Soviet Union but the Russian Empire, which includes countries like, well, certainly the Baltics, Finland, all the former Soviet republics, and chunks of the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Romania, you name it. So he's got this idea he's going to be the new Ivan the Terrible, and he's going to be a force to be reckoned with. Unfortunately for him, he supposedly has cancer, and he's being treated with chemotherapy, is what I've read. And, you know, people have noticed sometimes he's rather puffy looking. You know, the idea, you know, he became quite popular.
Oh, how old is he? Wait, do you have any idea how old?
He's 72 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of Trump people, you know, they loved him because he, you know, was this macho image. They had pictures of him. Of course, these were all photoshopped of him riding on a bear. Without a shirt on, doing all these macho things. But recent pictures of him would suggest
I wonder what those guys. I mean, he clearly is not worried about knocking people off. But Lou, it had to be a couple of years ago. Jimmy, I don't think you were doing the show then. But Lou sent me all this stuff about Russian railroads. This is when the Ukraine thing kind of started. And when we put sanctions on them, you know, the Biden, I'm sure Trump's got the same things, but some of the sanctions really hurt. And one of them was you guys probably know, but one of the biggest makers, the reason why railroads run is because of Timken roller bearings, right? And they couldn't get Timken roller bearings for their railroad. And they couldn't get spare parts for locomotives. And they're pretty much all a rail system, right? And a lot of the system is only one track. So if a train conks or a car has a hot box, which is what happens when you get where roll bearings go, you can't send another train. You can't just go around it. You got to somehow get it the hell out of there, and you're pulling a cripple and moving the car. According to Lou, this is a year and a half ago. Now, either they've got a workaround on roller bearings or somebody else has given them to it or whatever. But these are things people would normally not even think of. But how does he look at his economy, look at the fact that when he sent people to Ukraine, they didn't have enough uniforms because the guy who was supposed to make the uniforms bought himself a yacht instead, right? How does he look at his, it's like me looking in a mirror and saying I can be a pro wrestler tomorrow or something. I mean, what's he seeing? Her economy is the size of, Delaware or something? I don't see how he, in his worldview, he wants to go conquer all those places again, but how the hell is he going to do it? As a KGP guy, you would think he would have some training in that. Do you think he ever, there are all these stories of Trump going to Moscow and stuff, you're saying how he was in Dresden. Do you think they ever came together during Trump's early years of going to Russia?
Well, that's an interesting point you make, because I have done a deep dive into Trump's activities, especially after he married Ivana Zelnikova in 1977. Now, her father was a known Czechoslovak intelligence agent. He was based in probably one of the most communist cities in Czechoslovakia at the time. It was actually so communist, they renamed the town after Clement Gottwald, who was the Czechoslovak Communist Party General Secretary. It's now reverted back to its original name, Zlin, but it's in Bohemia, which, if you're looking at the map, you have the northwestern part of Czechoslovakia, and Zlin is about a 2.5 hour drive from Dresden, and that was an open border because they were all both Soviet satellite states. Now, Trump, Trump is, he goes over to visit, his wife's parents. Donald Jr. spends his summers there with his grandfather, helping to actually raise him. And so the question comes up, what was Putin briefed on when he was in Dresden in the late 80s, and this is when Donald Trump is making his trip to Moscow. And to,
when did she die?
Ivana?
Yeah.
I was just a couple of years ago. He was in the White House the first term.
That's right, but they've been divorced for a long time, right?
Yeah, they'd been divorced, but they remained friends, and Trump was giving her money. She was doing some QVC stuff, like selling her line of Ivana Trump products on Schlock.
Well, when he came and sang at Wrigley Field, which had to be, Sammy Sosa was around, so that had to be the 90s, he was already with this one, because she's the one who was there with him.
Oh, yeah. So they remained friends, and then she took a fall down the steps at her condo in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and now she's buried at the golf course over in Bedminster. Last time somebody looked at it, it was all grown up in weeds.
Well, don't you, if you get the place judged to be a cemetery, don't your taxes go down?
He gets a tax exemption because his golf course doubles as a cemetery.
That's so special.
What a nice family.
God. So there might have been a connection, but nobody knows.
Yeah.
Between him and
there might have been. I mean, going back to that time frame, the KGB was the master of all the Eastern European, Eastern Communist Bloc intelligence agencies. So, if you've got Trump's first father-in-law is a Czechoslovak intelligence agent, ultimately they all are going to be reporting to the KGB, and the Czechoslovaks actually mastered they were the ones that the Soviets relied on to do sexual blackmail activity of Western politicians. And they put agents in New York and Washington who were able to actually penetrate into the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI and in New York and into business there, including an industry kind of famous or infamous in Manhattan, the modeling industry.
Oh, yeah.
Well, two things that I know Wayne has looked into that he didn't mention for brevity's sake, but one, in this Washington situation, there were certain bars that were located near the White House, which are described in declassified CIA files as places where there'd be swinger operations, and where people would be recruited into sexual encounters. And I think there was a Czech component to that, wasn't there, Wayne?
Yeah, the Czechoslovak intelligence, they were a married couple who were involved in Manhattan operations at some swingers clubs there, including one very nasty place called Plato's Retreat, which apparently had also attracted John Bolton when he was a young State Department employee.
Really?
Yeah, it came out in his divorce papers with his first wife. It says right there that his first wife said, yeah, he forced me to go to this awful place called Plato's Retreat. And we only know about that because they tried to keep those divorce papers records sealed, but it was Larry Flint who was able to have him released.
Wait, is that a connection between that and... Because I think you guys are pretty good about saying this is not just one side of the aisle or the other. Is there any connection between that and the guy who was running for senator ahead against Obama here in Illinois? That he,
well, Jack Ryan.
Yeah, what?
Oh, it's you know, there's always a possibility if you're going to show your butt and out there in public, pun intended. yeah, you're gonna be attracting a lot of people, including intelligence agents who specialize in.
Was he in New York, or was, I thought he was in Europe, the wife was complaining about Ryan.
It was in Paris, wasn't it, where she, I think she said that he forced her to go to some sort of a sex club in Paris. Whether there were additional places in the States, I don't recall that, but.
And that was in divorce papers that were supposed to be sealed,
and they were unsealed, right? Yeah.
And one of the things that happens is that judges have a certain amount of discretion that may or may not be abused depending on your partisan viewpoint on whether you'd like to see the information.
Well, I don't see how this stuff, because we're gonna have to go to break here in 2 minutes, because when we come back we'll talk a little bit about, because our producer today happens to be an expert in the mortgage industry. And I just, my question to Jimmy yesterday was, this lady in the Federal Reserve, you know, they're accusing of having, you know, two properties that were supposedly principal remedies or whatever it was. Frankly, how does somebody get into that information? And I know now that Trump's people are doing their best to say they can get into people's IRS, Social Security, and everything.
Yeah.
It's not... You know, and of course, I sent the thing out to everybody, and, you know, some of the guys write back, hey, if it's a crime, it's a crime. Okay, fine, but I get that part. But the fact is, we don't want to live in a place where if you feel like it, you can put the squad car out in front of, you know, Andrew's house, and every time he goes somewhere, he's going to follow him and make sure he doesn't go 1 mile. I mean, yeah, if he's over the limit, somebody's going to say, oh, well, yeah, he should have got a ticket. But it's not the way necessarily you want to live in this country either, I don't think. But anyway, S&P futures down 22, NASDAQ futures down 82. I thought we'd be up this morning here. Wrong, oh. I'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Jimmy on the board. S&P futures now down 21. The NASDAQ futures only down 77. So, it seems like the S&P's down more, but they're actually both about the same, 0.3%. Over in Europe, we'll get the DAX down 80.3%. They were supposed to open up last night, and they did, and they've turned around. FTSE down 14.1%. FTSE, I think, was up like almost a percent last night when I looked, and now they're not. CAC around down 52.6. Over in Asia, we got the Nikkei down 278.6%. Been down for a couple days now, but they have been flying up. Hang Seng down 61.2%. Shanghai up 4. That's been the one that's really rallied now lately, all of a sudden, but not today. They're only up 4. Call that unchanged. Bonds unchanged at 4.30. The bond up 3 basis points, 2.75. Oil, which can't go anywhere. It's actually up 46 cents today, but still 63.17. Now it's banging around in the kind of the low mid 60s. Again, three, four weeks ago, Jimmy, I think there was a top tick on a Monday morning of 77. That was a nice sale. Not so good of a buy. Gold down $6, had a big rally yesterday. 33.82, silver unchanged, 37.80. Foreign exchange, which has been a little volatile. Today it's 116.48, so the euro's up a little bit. British pound up a little bit. Dollar falls as Trump calls on Fed's Cook to resign. I don't know if there's a connection there or not. The crypto that we've been talking about, down 714, 113,000. Still pretty high, but it was over 120 a week ago, so it's down some from there. Jimmy, we got for us traffic, weather, sports, Cubs win.
Yes, they did. Cubs did win last night. They beat the Brewers, and that is three straight for them, 4-3. Unfortunately, the White Sox did lose to the Braves, 1-0. The Diamondbacks did beat the Guardians, 3-2. The Cubs and Brewers are at it again tonight, and I believe the White Sox as well as the Braves. In regards to, right now it is 69 degrees at 7:33 in Chicago. It will be cloudy but cool and less humid than it has been for the last couple of days. Phoenix has a high of 90, or right now it's 90 and a high of 120, so they do have an extreme heat warning in effect. Traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 33, inbound Edens from Lake Cook 48, inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 45, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 30, and the inbound Stevenson to the Dan Ryan is 48. Back to you, Tom.
The guys, I want to talk a little bit about how this stuff this sort of targeted, and I'm not saying
interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience.
This stuff, I'm Audrey Johnson, owner of Home Source Realty and frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks radio show. If you're thinking about purchasing real estate this summer, could be a good
there we go. You guys, I'm sure remember the Elliot Spitzer thing when he was nailed for the
I wrote about that, yes.
Well, we didn't go the night when you guys were here. If you'd been able to stay a little longer, we probably, when the Buckingham had their bar, it was like the traders, the guys that were members of the club would hang in there. So that week, I went, you know, I know all these guys, and good guys, but, you know, they got the trader mentality, and they, Elliot Spitzer was not, traders are really odd creatures, guys. You don't like anybody basically hosing you, but if somebody decides they're gonna go after them, then you don't like that guy either, right? Because traders were so independent, they wanted everybody to behave, but then they really didn't like it if someone on the outside tried to make people behave. So there was, Elliot Spitzer went after the somebody invested interests in the New York Stock Exchange. And even though people on the CBOE, unbeknownst to many people, were a significant percentage of all the trades done in the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, somebody come in and buy, you know, 100 calls in a 50 delta option, the first thing somebody do is buy 5,000 shares in New York. And if somebody sold the calls, you'd sell the 5,000 shares out. I mean, so a lot of the traffic in stock came from the CBOE floor. And you knew which specialists were obeying the rules and which weren't. Somebody'd have something offered an eighth, you go to buy it there, magically traded ahead, specialist, duh, and he'd sell it to you at a quarter. I mean, you knew who the crooks were. But the New York Stock Exchange seemingly couldn't figure it out. So Spitzer decided to go after these guys and then say that the SEC was not, anyway. So he was not popular in the industry because he actually invaded it, even though the people he went after were stone cold guilty. So that's kind of an odd view of a trader mentality, but you guys both get where I'm coming from with that, right? So the dudes don't like Spitzer. So all of a sudden the guy's arrested for bringing hookers basically across state lines. Well, the reason why they get the guy, and I'm talking to these guys at the bar, and I go, guys, you know, that could happen to you. And they go, what do you mean? And I said, well, you guys are big swinging bleeps, right? Oh, yeah. You know, typical trader guys. And I said, now, if you're going to go to Vegas, and I know you like to go out there, it'd be an insult if you didn't go with at least 5-6 grand in your pocket. Well, yeah. I said, well, if your wife wants to paint the house and the painter wants getting paid cash and you pay him 8 grand, you got no problem with that. Well, no. I said, okay, what if I, because I didn't like you, looked and see in the last 6 months there's been 7 or 8 different $5,000 to $8,000 moves of cash out of your account. So I put a phone tap on you. Well, wait a minute, why would you do that? Well, that's what they did to Spitzer. Really? Yeah. So what if I did it to you? And all of a sudden, you find yourself a hooker in Indiana. And are you going to jail? Why would they do that to me? I said, that's what they did to him. I mean, this idea of you don't like somebody, you go after them. It's not like it's the first time it's happened, but it seems like it's... How exactly, if I'm sitting here talking to you two learned gents, how the hell would I find out what's on your mortgage application?
Well, in this case, it was the director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. And so what he did, and he's a big Trump ally and appointee, and he puts stuff out on social media about Lisa Cook, who's the first African-American woman ever to serve as a Fed governor. And he puts it out, and immediately President Trump, who appointed him to this Federal Housing Finance Agency, says, oh, she's got to resign. So it's not based on just what we know, and you could look at any kind of in-depth article from the last few days, or the listeners could. We know how it got out. It's the head of the agency put it out.
Yeah, and it's not the only example of this with going after people for mortgages. They're going after Adam Schiff, and they're going after Letitia James in New York. Letitia James is so egregious that this guy, Ed Martin, who couldn't be confirmed as U.S. attorney for D.C., then they had to replace him with Jeanine Pirro, the drunk lady from Fox News. They put Ed Martin in charge of weaponization of the Justice Department, not to combat it, but to do it. And apparently he wore a trench coat standing in front of Letitia James's house in Brooklyn and had these photos taken that they're using now, I guess, as campaign literature for Trump.
Well, how does Trump accuse anybody else of lying on a loan application, for God's sake.
Easy. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is rich, isn't it? I mean, the guy who actually is convicted, he's a convicted criminal, is trying to do that to other people.
But it comes to the point where does the guy through his computer just have access? They give him a list of here's 50 people we don't like, and the guy gets to go through all their documents and just to see if there's something wrong in his opinion?
Well, he's head of the agency.
Yeah, I know, but if you were head of the agency, you wouldn't do that.
Well, but then if I wouldn't do it, I'd be fired. So I wouldn't like
that. Well, that happened to the IRS commissioner that Trump put in there, this former Missouri congressman and auctioneer,
Billy Long.
Billy Long. They wanted tax data, I guess, on people they thought were here illegally or whatnot, and he refused, and they fired him. So there's no honor amongst thieves in this case.
2 months after he was confirmed, well, they transferred him out. They're going to make him an ambassador to Iceland, I think.
Put him on ice.
And of course, they put him on ice. And of course, that's a huge insult to, whatever country is a dumping ground. They know that, this is what the U.S. thinks of us. By the way, Billy Long, congressman from Springfield part of Missouri, who former radio host, a great gift of being able to talk fast, which is why he was an auctioneer. But before he was appointed, he's a former congressman who tried to step up to a bigger race and lost. But he was running a consulting company on advising people on borderline situations, how to get out of their IRS problems. So we see even he wouldn't do what they wanted in turning over data, undoubtedly to be used as this kind of smear campaign for political purposes. And of course, if they get rid of, think of the three people. They get rid of a Fed governor, makes it easier to raise interest rates no matter what the data or economy says.
Lower.
Yeah. Misspoke, sorry. And then if they get rid of Adam Schiff, who led the impeachment, who's now the U.S. Senator from California, and they get rid of Letitia James, who's the Attorney General for New York, You're marching down the enemies list one by one, and this is all in the first few months of the administration.
Well, what are you guys sensing? My big question today to you gentlemen is: I heard somebody on the radio yesterday. I don't know who the hell it was a Republican senator from somewhere going, this is going way too far. Is there any sort of pushback? Not from the, the Trump tribe of total lapdogs, but is there any pushback outside that, I'll say, in core group as to what are we doing here? Is there any realization
really, because they're all gone. I mean, there used to be some pushback from John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, but now he's got a primary challenge from the very crooked Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. And now they're trying to outdo one another and seeing who can manipulate the government more to go after Trump's enemies. Even where you have a guy with a record of, I'll put this in quotation marks, moderation, because I think all the Republican moderates are basically gone. Their political lifespan is severely shortened if they're even thought of.
But everybody, I hope in this country, although I'm starting to lose some faith in this, I hope everybody has a limit of what they're willing to take. Even if you are the R word, a Republican, it's not like every single one of them is immoral and is willing to let this go the whole way. I honestly don't believe that. I mean, there's somebody going, I don't want any part of this. I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of want to lob at you guys, because I think you're two pretty moral dudes. This stuff that's going on in Gaza, I mean, I know the, you know, Netanyahu's attitude is, well, you know, 15 civilians got killed. Well, they shouldn't have been there. By the way, they're Palestinians anyway. He may have that view. And maybe, who was our guy in Iraq, Rumsfeld, he may have had that view. But other people didn't. I mean, when Jimmy Stewart was a decorated and a serious bomber pilot, he evidently, when he came back from the war, he was very troubled for a long time. And I don't know if he saw a psychologist or he didn't, but evidently his group bombed, I don't think they made the mistake, they bombed a city where they thought there was a munitions plant and there wasn't, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And he was troubled with that. He was. Now, whoever gave the order, whoever the general up the chain, maybe he's saying they're all German, oops, I don't care. But Jimmy Stewart didn't feel that way. Now, I'm saying, when, even though somebody up the chain in Israel might say, hey, we knocked off a few people we missed, that doesn't mean the guy who shot the thing or dropped the bomb feels that way. He might say, what did I just do? I mean,
there's many Israeli military people, both still in the military and veterans, who have, you know, basically spoken out about the war crimes they think have been committed. I think Netanyahu is going to have a very crude awakening at this year's General Assembly session in New York, which is next month, because there's a whole long list of nations getting ready to recognize Palestine as an independent state. And these countries are not, I mean, among them are Canada, the UK, France, Australia.
Now, that doesn't include Gaza, right? We're talking about the other side.
They're recognizing the Palestinian state as it's recognized already by several countries, which includes the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know Gaza was part of that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Who are these guys? Good thing you guys come on and get to ask these questions. The people were asking why was Putin in Alaska? Who's this group of 122 nations that we didn't sign that have him wanted as a war criminal? Did it almost to the point where we had to have him here because he'd been arrested anywhere else?
Yeah.
ICC, who are those guys?
The International Criminal Court, it's based on the Treaty of Rome, which I think 1993 or 4. Anyway, Bill Clinton wanted the U.S. to join, but he saw the writing on the wall. It would get nowhere near a ratification in the Senate, so the U.S. never became a party to it. But like as you say, 122 countries are, and just this morning, Marco Rubio put sanctions on all the judges of the International Criminal Court, which sits in The Hague in the Netherlands, and he's actually going after their, you know, trying to freeze any finances they have in the U.S. One of the judges is a Canadian. So once again,
well, why does he want to do that? What did they do to anybody other than say
because
he's a criminal? He is.
They've indicted Netanyahu as a war criminal. They've also indicted Putin as a war criminal. And I can see Marco, the new Marco seems to be, who used to be Mr. Anti-Communist, now seems to be very pro-Russian.
Where do you think this all? I mean, like I said earlier in the show, if he somehow with his odd style pulls this off, you know, I'll take my hat off to the man. But there's all these questions regarding guarantees. Now, is that guarantee as strong as a treaty? Does that have to be ratified? It seems like there's questions all over the damn place. Or is it just me?
The only way you can guarantee the security of Ukraine is by having NATO troops in the country, ideally to have Ukraine as a member in NATO. Now, almost, I think every other NATO country, except for the two that have pro-Putin puppets in charge, that's Slovakia and Hungary, every other NATO country is in favor of Ukraine being a full member in NATO, except for these two outliers, which now includes the United States. Trump is basically now making phone calls to Lukashenko, the dictator in Belarus. That's one of the few Russian allies there is left in the world. We already know Trump, North Korea, they're sending weapons and troops to help Russia. And we know that Trump, his pen pal up there, Kim Jong-un, is still in charge of that place. And China is supporting Russia. So it looks like we're a member of the rogues.
How can we possibly, if Putin wants NATO nowhere near the place, how the hell are we going to give a guarantee? What's the difference?
Well, Trump is, he's indicated the U.S. might put air resources over Ukraine. Right now, it's a huge no-fly zone. I would be surprised if he would commit any U.S. Military resources to Ukraine. I think his hatred for Zelensky goes back to the phone call that ensured his first impeachment. I think he's just got, they may be friendly now and shaking hands and whatnot, but I think he has a visceral hatred for Zelensky.
And I think also there's a good argument that the meeting with Putin was basically for the U.S. to sell out Ukraine. And what happened was the European leaders said, no, we've got to counter that in the nicest way as possible. So they dropped everything that they're doing to come to the U.S., including two countries that whose position is important, Finland, which has this huge border with Russia, and Italy, which has a very conservative prime minister. And Trump likes the leader personally of both of those countries, and they dropped whatever else they were doing to join Germany, France.
How long were those guys even in Washington? Like a half hour?
I think it was maybe overnight.
It's a show of support for Ukraine to stop Ukraine from being isolated and sold out to help Putin basically win the war and carve up Ukraine. That's why they were there. And they had a limited objective, in my view, that they succeeded on, which was stop the sellout by the U.S. of Ukraine that would help Putin basically break the back of Ukraine and position himself for further gains in Europe. And they succeeded, and there were smiles and photos, but it was a very serious game behind the scenes that I think backfired on Trump and the United States.
What is the? I was looking at the map, and I don't know that much. Is the Crimea, or are there some spots there that anyone can justify other than that they got it, saying this is now Russia?
The Crimea is the odd area out of this, because when there was a Soviet Union, Crimea was part of the Russian portion of the Soviet Union until 1954, when Nikita Khrushchev basically ceded it to Ukraine. Now, this is all within the USSR, so when you say ceded, it wasn't between independent countries. and of course,
you gave a chunk of Illinois to Indiana.
Yeah, exactly. Is that going to be taken up by the United Nations as a as an illegal territorial gain? No, because it's within the United States. And that's what happened with Crimea. Also, Crimea, historical attachment to Russia. You had the Crimean War, and it also is the headquarters of the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
Why did Khrushchev ever do that?
It's always been, it's one of the mysteries. Yeah, why did he do it? He thought, well, it would make more sense for Crimea and to improve their economy, to be attached to Ukraine as a place from where Ukraine could sell its wheat internationally, because it's a huge, it's called the granary of Europe, Ukraine. And so, but, you know, a lot of people thought it was, well, he's just awarding it as a gift to the Ukrainians. But really, it did not make a lot of sense. And I think if there were land swaps, I know it wouldn't be very popular with the Ukrainians, but I think Crimea may be one of the places they'd be willing to, in exchange for a secure peace and membership in the EU and NATO, I think they would be, you know, willing to eat it on that one, you know.
Well, here's two things that are, I think, are important to attack a couple of maybe myths or at least dubious so-called facts that most Americans probably aren't aware of. One is the history of Crimea. It depends when you date it from. So there are a large number of Americans who say, let's let Trump stop the war. You know, Crimea has always been a part of Russia. Let him have it back. Well, that depends on when you start your chronology. So if you say the last couple hundred years, yeah, it's mostly been part of Russia. But if you go back further, it's been part of what we might think of Ukraine. Now, of course, there weren't nation states then. There's like rulers, kings. So you get into definitional issues here. But the reason the Ukrainians are fighting and fighting for Crimea, among other places, is they think of themselves as a separate, most of them, not all of them, as a separate country that just because Russia has occupied Crimea and some other parts for a long time doesn't negate their patriotism for a lot of them.
Are they, I mean, I've never been there. Lou has spent a lot of time. When you say, you know, Russia gave it up to Ukraine, well, they're not really, I mean, the attitude, I guess in Illinois, nobody really cares if you're in Illinois or Indiana, but they have more of an attitude like Texas, where we're really our own country. We're just hanging with you guys for a while, and we're liable to leave when we feel like it. I mean, it seems like this is, you, I mean, what was the government in, quote, Russia versus the government in Ukraine, and how did it affect the people in the Crimea at all?
Well, the other interesting factor is that Crimea used to have a majority Turkish population. Now they're called the Tatars. And Stalin basically, you know, Stalin was infamous for taking groups of people and moving them to the far-flung parts of, mostly in Siberia. But the Tatar people are a Turkic people. They still represent 10% of the population of Crimea. And so Erdogan in Turkey now is talking about Crimea being in the Turkish sphere of influence. So he has started to make nice with Ukraine because I think he sees maybe Crimea's future is more with Turkey than it is with anyone else, if the Tatar population is allowed to return. So here we have another one.
Return from where? Siberia?
Yeah.
I mean, could this get more complicated?
No.
Some of them are in Siberia, and one of Wayne's books writes about these different ethnic groups scattered in different countries, including this population. And if you follow this stuff closely, a lot of sabotage occurs in this part of Siberia against Russia. And, you know, you got railways bringing materials. You talked about that earlier, Chief. There are a variety of mysterious derailments and other bombs on these kind of isolated rail lines.
It's pretty hard to police 1,000 miles of railroad out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, particularly if you have an ethnic population of Tatars who live out there, banished decades ago to Siberia, who may have some affection for what's called Ukraine.
Not only that, there's at least three enclaves of Ukrainians living deep inside of Russia and Siberia, and where these Ukrainians, they're a significant part of the local population, and there too you also have seen some acts of sabotage.
Well,
I wonder who might be doing it.
Maybe next week. I don't know. This is my manufacturing background. Whenever somebody says they'd have to return, I immediately go, "How the hell? So how is this going to work? You show up with a long passenger train, you put everybody on there with whatever they can carry, and they get their old house back, or how do you? What is the logistics of this? It's like the Cuban people here think if we ever get rid of the people in Cuba, they're going to go back and get their old house back and their old farm. I can't imagine that working if you've been living two generations someplace. All of a sudden, okay, our real home's over there. Let's go grab our house and our farm back. I mean, even if you wanted to do it, how do you do it?
Well, that's why it's a war crime, and that's why you have the International Criminal Court says it's to collapse a few things in the last moments here, but it's a war crime because it's so bad to do it, because it's unworkable, so you want to make it a very bad thing to stop people from doing it.
What do the Russians gain by hauling these people out in the middle of the cold? What are they doing out there, mining stuff for them, or what are they doing?
Well, Stalin originally deported many of these people because during World War II, many of them hated the Russians to the point that they would have rather welcomed the Germans just to free themselves from Russian domination. So Stalin decided, well, we don't need any fifth column in these parts of the Soviet Union. So he had these populations deported in total out to the middle of Siberia.
Is that why Putin's always saying there's the fascist remnants?
Well, you know, but you look at his politics and he's embraced a lot of these same fascist elements.
But I'm saying he's blaming it on those people. That's why he's doing this, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, guys, who's who? You're Andrew, Florida, Andrew in Washington, Wayne in Florida?
Yeah, I'm sweltering in Florida right now.
Well, at least this hurricane, what are the nicest hurricane? Went right between Carolina and Bermuda and didn't mess with anybody. I think it was huge.
And the one behind it seems to be going in the same direction, fortunately.
Well, we don't want one going to Mar-a-Lago. God. All right, guys. Well, thank you very much. Good stuff as usual. A lot of good stuff you sent me, Andrew. I shipped it to my place. I'm going to read it all on Saturday because, I mean, a lot of it I want to read pretty carefully. So keep that coming. I'll talk to you guys next week. Jimmy, nice job. SP Futures down 27. NASDAQ Futures down 105. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.